With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Achtung Millwall supports the Lions Food Hub, and all of our advertising revenues will be donated to support this fantastic initiative. It's now based at the Lions Centre on Bolina Road, and it's run by our own Kelly Webster. This is a friendly food bank supporting families in the Bermondsey and SE16 area. If you can help support the Lions Food Hub in any way, please visit at Lions Food Hub on Twitter or get in touch with us at Achtung Millwall. The Lions Food Hub. Come on, you Lions.
You're listening to Achtung Millwall, broadcasting from the beautiful South Burnham. Accept no substitute.
Hello, dear listeners. Welcome to a special edition of Nick and Neil's History Hour. This might be about a Nick and Neil's History Half Hour. Joining me in this virtual studio is Mr. Neil Fissler. How are you doing, Neil?
Hello, Nick. Yeah, no, well, we've got a brand new studio, no expense spared.
We do.
By StreamYard.
Yeah, we are. Highly recommended, and I can endorse it, actually. It's very simple. And if I ever wanted to go down the video route, which I don't, then it'd be great, ideal setup. But Neil, we spoke recently to an author, football author, quite a well-known chap, Mark Metcalf, to talk about one of Millwall's greatest defenders, Charlie Hurley. It was a fascinating conversation, wasn't it?
Yeah, so Charlie Hurley, one of those players who's almost forgotten by the, or probably isn't even known by the younger generation these days.
No.
But was a player who joined us in the early 50s and revered at the time. I've spent, two or three very, very, very good seasons at Millwall, and moved on to Sunderland, where he went on to even bigger and greater things.
Absolutely.
Interestingly, has been voted in Millwall's Team of the Century.
Yeah.
And made the same side, but for Sunderland as well, which is no mean feat.
No, it's not. It's not. A great player, and also possibly a victim of the way that football was structured back then. I mean, nowadays he would almost certainly have played at a much, much higher level than, in fairness, even Sunderland, who were the second division and middling kind of first division side at the points in the 60s. Nowadays, I think a player of Charlie Hurley's stature would command the very biggest money, and we kind of touch on that in our conversation with Mark Metcalf. This is part of a longer conversation, listeners. We've just distilled the Millwall section, as this is the Millwall History Half an Hour with Nick and Neil. If you want to listen to the full conversation, do tune into our Football History podcast. We've got the whole of Charlie's life covered with Mark, and that includes Sunderland and Reading and other clubs where he went on to play. But I thought we just cut out the Millwall part for our Millwall show. So we're going to cut over to that now. And Neil and I will be back after we've heard from Mr. Mark Metcalf.
Achtung, Millwall.
How did he end up at Millwall? I mean, it's a great story in itself. Obviously, like a lot of people from his background, high levels of poverty in Ireland. So they moved from Cork almost immediately on his birth. In fact, the next time he went back to Ireland was actually to play for Ireland 20 years later. He lived in East London during the Blitz, one of the tragedies early in his life. He was out playing football with a great mate of his called Gordon Smith. And what happened was the air and sirens went off, and his dad had always insisted that he come home. He was half and half. He was going to go to Gordon's house. You probably know what the rest of the tale is. Mm. He went home. Following day, he woke up, and unfortunately, his mate had been killed. The whole family had been slaughtered. So he was lucky in that respect. I mean, football is a different era. Obviously, Second World War, massive crowds, but there wasn't the scouting systems which took place. But he played for Essex. He played good local football. Initially, he didn't have any football boots. His mum and dad couldn't afford that. And when he did get them, obviously, they were his prized possessions. It's not like today. He played in them for three years. My son is 13, 14, and he doesn't play in football boots and doesn't get as much kick out of them as well. But, you know, that would be the situation. Fortunately, you know, we've got a better standard of living today.
Absolutely.
West Ham sought to sign him, by which point he had, in fact, got a job at Ford's Dagenham, like a lot of Irish people. And his dad was a tool maker there. Charlie was an apprentice, wasn't really apprentice. It wasn't a serious trade. Nevertheless, the pay he got was more than what he was offered to sign for West Ham. And in a large family, the family needed the extra pound a week. So he turned it down. He was playing for Raynham Youth Club in a final, and there was a lad there who was rated to be a top class player, and Charlie marked him out of the game. And afterwards, Bill Voysey, who obviously worked for Millwall for a very long time, he seen him and he said, "Do you fancy signing for Millwall?" Charlie's a fairly sort of matter of fact type character, and when I interviewed him, he said, "You know, why would anybody?" He says, "I was trying to take no notice of this old bloke, you know, wanting him to go away." And he said, "Why would anybody want to sign me on the basis of one game?" But in fact, Millwall did want to sign him. And he sat down with Bill and he sat down with Charlie Hewitt, who was the manager of Millwall at the time. And he signed for the club at, you know, twice what his wages were at the Ford's Dagenham.
Yeah.
What was also quite a nice story is that the foreman where he was at was saying, "Hey, Charlie," I can't do the Irish accent, I can't do any other Irish.
Probably
accent.
Best you don't try, Mark.
I think it's probably a wise move, to be fair. So he basically said to him, he was telling them, like, you know, you could get injured, you'd be better off stopping here. Of course, really? All the rest of the working class blokes where he was working, they were like,
"Take it.
Are you crackers?" cheering him to the rafters, you know what I mean? "Come on, go on, do your best." Like, you know, like most working class
people. Most people would do,
they would want one of their own. Obviously, it's a very popular song, "He's One of Our Own." It's not just about that they're from the same area, arts, because they're from the same sort of class background, isn't it, really? It's an opportunity to get out of the grimy, horrible place to work. Ford's Dagenham. I've got many friends who have worked there. I'm not doing them a disservice by saying it was horrible.
No, if you have a choice of playing football for a living, Mark,
given the choice, you take the football. Yeah. Of course you do. I mean, we've charted this extremely well in the book on Fred Spikes. He called him the first great working class footballer. You know, that joy of not having to go to work and doing something you want to do and outside. Yeah. And so, you know, Charlie, he was 16, very good footballer. Even at 16, he made his debut, his first team debut for Millwall at the age of 17. So it shows what a good player he was. Went down to Torquay. They went there and back in the same day.
We're talking about 1953 here, Mark, aren't we?
1954. We're talking 1954. He was born 36, birthday in the October. Played in the January the 30th. 1954, 2's a piece draw. For the game, all the lads in the team are saying to him, "Just do your best, you'll be okay." And afterwards, they're all saying, "Bye, who are you? Can you play like that every week?" You know, he'd made a real impression on these footballers. The Millwall were in the third division south. They were doing okay, and they did do okay the first couple of seasons. But the problem with that was that to go up, you had to finish top, and they didn't. They finished fifth on one occasion, but then struggled a little bit. The man who had the most impression, without doubt, on Charlie as a footballer was the goalkeeper, Malcolm Phillinson, who went on to replace Bert the Cat Williams at Wolverhampton Wanderers. Probably, Williams probably the greatest goalkeeper that's ever played for Wolves. And they've had one or two good ones over the years. But Malcolm wasn't very far behind him. He didn't play internationally because he was in Scotland and they had a few good goalkeepers. Well, Malcolm's attitude was quite straightforward. Firstly, even 40 years later when Charlie seen him, Charlie referred to him as his dad. So right. That gives you an idea of who was some in charge impact. Of that defence, basically.
Yeah.
And Malcolm was as is one. He just said, if I'm coming for the ball, get out of the way. And if you don't get out of the way, not only will I get the ball, but I'll get you. And that was Malcolm's attitude. He was an exceptionally talented goalkeeper, a very, very brave goalkeeper. And proved ultimately to be a brilliant signing by Stan Cullis, played behind the great Billy Wright, and in a fantastic Wolves team. Well, he was a big impression. There were other players, John Shepherd, for example, up front, who was a talented goal scorer, very mobile footballer, John Shepherd, and a brave player. I don't know if you have ever interviewed his daughter, but his daughter did that fantastic.
She has a book. Yeah.
That's a really, is it just from something like The Lion's Den? I'm forgetting it.
In and Out of the Lion's Den or something.
In and Out of the Lion's Den. Yeah. Fantastic. Yeah, Julie, fantastic book.
Yeah.
Yeah. Julie, very nice young lady.
Yeah. Yeah. A great, great book. I've got some copies and all that. I was delighted to read it as well. But the atmosphere at Millwall, according to one or two others, like Bill Lloyd, who became a goalkeeper as well, a few of them wasn't that good. Charlie Hewitt was very much the old school type manager, and
he divided opinion. Mark is the modern.
He divided opinion. Yes, he divided. That's one way of putting it. Yes,
cheerful indeed. Charlie Hewitt.
He was to be ironically sacked on New Year's Day, which was a bit of a cruel way of being got rid of in 1956 and replaced by Ron Gray. Now, Charlie actually came into the team and he replaced what was slightly unusual in his place, Jerry Bowler, who was also a ball-playing centre-back. Malcolm says that you could come off a game in muddy conditions and you would have thought Jerry might have just come on at the end, so right. Clean were his clothes at this point. Now, that definitely wasn't the case with Charlie. He got stuck in. But the admiration that the Millwall fans, and they had some hard players at Millwall, Stan Anslow, who was a very, very good footballer, and who at one point actually was pushed upfield in one of the seasons and scored over a dozen league goals. He was there's that wall down the side, isn't there, at Millwall? And he was fairly well known for putting opposing outside left or out into that wall, to be fair. He's still a good footballer. He took good penalties as well, as I understand it. Pat Sayward, obviously a very good, talented player for Millwall. But Charlie was loved not only because of his never-say-die attitude and his heading ability, because he could get the ball down and he could play. He could pass. And that was unusual. He took a gamble in the early stages at his career at Millwall to try and play. He was quite quiet. You know, he's taking in the things that were going on around him and learning. But at the same time, he did want to express the fact that he had skills. I mean, the fact that he tried to play football actually cost him when he went to Sunderland, because in his first two games, Sunderland conceded 7 and 6. And as he says, he went to the bingo one night and the bloke said 7 and 6 was Charlie Hurley worth it. So that was the case with Charlie. And he did, you know, he had a very poor couple of games. But yeah, so he was a very, very good player. he was in at the same time he had to do his national service, and that cost him perhaps the opportunity. Well, it did cost him the opportunity to play in the big game of the 1950s, which was the Birmingham City game in the quarterfinals, I believe, in the FA Cup. And Millwall had deservedly, and obviously, even now I'm still happy about that, managed to beat the reigning FA Cup holders, which was Newcastle United. And there's some great pictures, isn't there, of that game with the fans hanging on to the turnstile, hanging on to the floodlights. And there's some fantastic ones. Now, what had happened is that he'd actually said something slightly out misplaced, and so he wasn't going to be allowed off camp anywhere to play in the game. But in fact, it was already agreed in advance that he wasn't going to play in that match. They were going to keep the same side. Actually, it worked against Millwall, because Birmingham, they beat them easily, beat them 4-1, and obviously they went on to reach the final. They were beaten by Manchester City in the final. Arguably, Birmingham's greatest day up until they won the League Cup. It was 10 years or a decade ago. So Charlie was playing football. He also had a spell, which I'll come. The reason why he came back into the team was quite straightforward. He was missing for quite a long time because he suffered an injury whilst playing for the Army team. Right. It had actually been said to him he didn't have to play in this particular game, but he thought he would use it as a bit of a warm-up for his international debut against Spain. And the problem with that was that he got injured and he couldn't play. And he came back into the team, and they played him centre forward. They actually got well beat Millwall in both of those games. He came back, we scored in both of them. And if you ask Charlie now, he would tell you that given the opportunity, he would have played centre forward. His career would have been as a centre forward, and he regretted that at the end. Now, during the period of time Charlie was there, to give you some idea of how well he was playing, is he was selected for the first side from England to play in European football. So he was selected for the London side against Frankfurt, 24th of October, 1955, game played at Wembley.
England, and this was a combination team, Mark, wasn't it? London.
It was a combination team.
Combined.
Him and Vic Groves were the two from the third division. Bobby Robson, for example, was playing. And 2-0 down, they won 3-2. Papers generally agreed that if he wasn't the best player on the field, he's very close to it. Now, we're talking here a lad who had just gone age 19, who was showing that he was a good footballer in third division football. He could get the ball, he would fight hard for the ball. But against the top class footballers, he could also play. Problem was, he was injured by the time next time came along. And unfortunately, he never played European football again, which is why he was so keen in particular to play for Ireland.
The Ireland side,
Now he made his debut for Ireland before he went to Sunderland. It was in the summer of 57, end of the season, 56-57. Cut a very long story short, with less than 20 seconds remaining, Ireland were beating England 1-0. He'd come into the tide after they'd been hammered 5-1 at Wembley. Game was played at Dalymount Park in Dublin. First time he'd been back to Ireland. And if Ireland had held on to that, what would have meant is Ireland would have travelled to Denmark, which they subsequently won that game. And if they'd won that game, the two teams would have played off again to go to Sweden. He's up against Tommy Taylor, and he did very well. Irony of ironies, John Atio in particular scored the goal, if I recall rightly. John Atio was one of those players which Charlie often struggled against. You have certain players who you struggle against, and Atio was definitely one of them. His mobility and in the air always meant that a very good game of football was guaranteed between those two footballers. The other person who Charlie might have struggled against when he played, if there was the things, he did generally pretty well against one-to-ones, was Derek Dougan. Him and Derek Dougan a right battle royal, and Wyn Davies, who was Welsh. Also a great, yeah. a great footballer, played for Bolton and played for Newcastle. Yeah. Those were the three players you could see. Against the rest, he did pretty well. He played against Greaves, for example, at Roker Park on a number of occasions, and as Jimmy said, he never scored against them. Bit different down at White Hart Lane, where Jimmy scored a few goals against Charlie and some of the other players. But it was said of that Tottenham side of the six. No, I better not say that, otherwise I'm going to get into trouble of mates of mine who follow Tottenham Hotspur. So he moved for a fee of 18,000 in the October 57, plus a friendly, which brought in £3,000.
The different so times, Mark, isn't it?
21,000. Now, you'll work that out. That was the highest transfer fee at the time.
Yeah.
Was John Charles, which was £65,000. Now, if you work that out, so it was a third of the highest transfer fee. So a comparable figure in today's football is that Charlie Hurley would have been transferred at the age of 21, just 21, for a figure of about £35 million. Wow. That gives you an idea. It's the sort of sums of money that Rio Ferdinand was transferred from West Ham to Leeds, and then from Leeds on to Manchester United. It gives you just some idea of his standing. And that was despite the fact that his injury had left him with his ability certainly to make a sliding tackle, which were a key component of the game at that time. You can't get away with such tackles, of course, today. No question about that. So he would have been happy to be fair with that. So it gives you a good standard of how good he was.
Achtung, Mehlball.
Neil, what a fascinating story Charlie's life is. You know, it's a social history as much as it is a football history, isn't it?
Yeah, somebody like Mark, who very much is a social historian as well.
Yeah,
probably actually a little bit like yourself.
I think, it's relevant. I mean, obviously footballers travelled a long way. The impact of money is many-fold, and that was what wasn't in the lives of players of Charlie's background and in the game generally back then. I mean, came from a very poor background in Ireland and came to work for the Ford Works in Dagenham. And money was the driving factor. I mean, I thought it was great, the idea that you'd have a choice between working on the production line at Ford's or maybe turning down a football career because you got paid more making the motors, you know.
Yeah, but that was what happened back then, really, wasn't it? Now it's a no-brainer. Now you're offered millions at the age of 13, 14 to sign for clubs and agents or buy your parents' house and all kinds of underhand things. but back then it was really a choice, because if something happened to you playing football, you were buggered, because there was no real welfare state, was there, as such, in the early 50s. And no, certainly wasn't as easy as it is now.
I mean, these were hard men, and they, you know, we've touched on it already in other conversations, how the football world then, you had to be tough to survive. I mean, for Charlie back then, we're talking about the early 1950s, listeners, to suffer a cruciate knee ligament injury, which nowadays with modern treatment is, you know, is not an easy injury to sustain. But for him to come back from that and still maintain a top level career is incredible.
It says a lot about him as a person.
Yeah,
as well as the skill of the surgeon, because these days it's a relatively, I hate to say, it's a relatively minor injury. It's still quite a serious injury, but you're out for a year, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12 months, and you come back. You might have lost the odd yard of pace, but back in Charlie's day, that was career ending. Yeah, well, you think 70s and the 80s, and maybe even the 90s, Gazza was never quite the same after his cruciate knee ligament injury, was he? So it says a lot about Charlie Hurley as a character and about him as a footballer.
And is it you know, I hate this modern phrase, football intelligence, but it's kind of the only one we've got. But to manage your career, I mean, he suffered this cruciate injury at Millwall, but to manage that, the aftermath of that, and to yet go on to Sunderland and really, you know, the bulk of his career and the bulk of his best times were spent at Roker Park. But to be able to do that whilst managing an injury at that level speaks for me how intelligent a player he was.
Yeah, and yeah, but the treatment wouldn't have been very much, Dan.
No, it would have been basic, wouldn't it? You know, it would have been. Let's be honest.
Yeah, but it wouldn't have been almost. You'd like to have waited until you could walk and run again and then sent back out there, wouldn't you?
Absolutely.
Kneecap removed if there was all kind of, but no, to maintain a top level career and to win. Yeah, did Mark say that he won 40 international caps
for the Republic? Yeah.
And made two or three appearances with us, but went on to play over 30 times.
Absolutely.
When he was at Sunderland. Yeah, like to pound note, which.
Well, I don't blame a man. I mean, if he's come from poor circumstances, he'll know the value of his talent, won't he? And, you know, these were times where the football industry was starting to turn itself into something like the modern world of highly paid players. But there was always money in the game, listeners. It just went in the direction of the directors back then, didn't it, rather than to the players. It was a different difference in that sense.
Yeah, it was. Yeah, well, we say now that it's business orientated, but back then it was positively ruthless, wasn't it?
Players
were on minimum wages, and there were huge crowds came into football then. Okay, there wasn't the commercialisation.
No, a fascinating story, in my opinion. And there's a great quote on the Wikipedia page that the Irish have produced a great new world-class footballer in centre-back Charlie Hurley, and he would have been playing for Millwall at this time, listeners. So it's not often that you get that kind of sentence, Neil, is it? A world-class player.
From Millwall. Mentioned in the same breath is probably the first time ever, isn't it?
I haven't seen it very often, that's for sure. So there we are. I hope you enjoyed that Millwall slice of our conversation with Mark Metcalf. If you want to listen to the whole thing, we're going to put that out on the Football History Podcast channel. But we thought we'd do this just as a purely Millwall section for his Millwall years in the early 1950s. So big thank you to Neil Fissler for joining me for this Charlie Hurley special. It's nice to be able to do this kind of stuff, Neil, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And, well, we've got some more planned. Absolutely. One or two others in the pipeline. One or two people that we have spoken to and that we're hoping to get on in the very near future.
There we are. Good stuff. So stay tuned for further editions of Nick and Neil's Millwall History Hour, or possibly even half an hour. Sometimes it might be 40 minutes. We'll see. Till then, dear listeners, bye for now. So, dear listeners, there's nothing beloved of the Millwall heart more than a game against West Ham United. It's almost, it is in our blood, and I'm going to reinforce that point with you today because my eye fell upon a wonderful page. I think it must be from a Millwall history book, and I believe it was Stan LDN on Twitter, who posted a photo of a 1906 FA report into a particularly keenly contested local derby, as the sporting life of the 19th of September 1906 puts it, a keen local rivalry between West Ham and Millwall. The game was played in the Western League, dear listeners, the Western League, which was a kind of a reserve style league played at this time. Millwall and West Ham at this point were both Southern League clubs, but this game was played at Upton Park on the 17th of September 1906, and there was an FA report into the game afterwards. There is nothing new in this life, dear listeners. Nothing is ever new. So the commission reported on the events at Upton Park this day. The commissioners, shall we say, were Messrs. C.W. Alcock, Charles Alcock, who was one of the founder members of the FA and the creator of the FA Cup. I think he played
for Wanderers in the very first FA Cup final, C.W. Alcock. Captain E.G. Curtis, don't know him, but certainly anyone called Captain Curtis inspires authority. And one H. Porter, that's the three-man commission into the events at West Ham on the 17th of September 1906. I'll read it verbatim for you, there's not much to it. The commission, having taken evidence, are satisfied that this game was not contested in a friendly spirit, dear listeners. The play, on the whole, was far too vigorous, and there were many fouls which were unchecked. The match was not properly controlled by Mr. E. Case of the Cheshire FA, who was the referee. Consequently, we suspend Jarvis of West Ham for 14 days from the 30th of October for what we consider to be a serious foul against Dean of Millwall. In imposing this penalty, the Commission have regard to the player's previous good character. The players of both teams are censured and warned as to their future conduct. The referee, Mr. Case, is suspended for the whole season. With regard to the behaviour of spectators, the Commission are satisfied that there were unseemly incidents and that these were not sufficiently serious to warrant them taking any other action beyond requiring the West Ham club to post special notices at their ground, warning their spectators of the consequences which may result from misbehaviour. The clubs, having admitted their knowledge of the vigorous and foul play, and that the game was not controlled by the referee, one of the clubs having protested to the Western League against Mr. Case being appointed by the league in any of their future fixtures, are both severely censured for not having reported the matters to the FA. And then they go on to list some punishments for West Ham, that there should be a clear space of 10 feet between the touchline and the fence and supports of the spectators. That sheet iron advertisements shall not be attached to the fence. Sheet iron adverts shall not be attached to the fence unless the edges are protected. So bare edges were on show. And that there should be a clear space of 15 feet between the goalposts and the spectators. So the Sporting Life reports on a keenly contested rivalry which exists between these two East London combinations was plainly in evidence, it says, at Upton Park yesterday when a poor display resulted in a victory for West Ham by 1-0. An evenly contested game. Sounds like it was more rough stuff than actual flowing football, shall we say. Comrie left the field. The Mill player, George Comrie, left the field for an injury. And another Mill player, Dean, was actually mentioned in that FA report. Serious foul play by the West Ham player on Dean, who would have to leave the game also early in the match. Mill could make little headway, says the Sporting Life, and the result, West Ham 1, Mill 0. The Bolton Evening News goes into matters in a little bit more detail, dear listeners. It's only a paragraph. Bolton Evening News, up north, 18th of September, this edition. A free fight, a match, says the Bolton Evening News. At Upton Park yesterday, West Ham United played Millwall in their match in the Western League. So rough was the play of both sides that the game soon lost all interest. The hostile spirit was not confined to the players. Oh dear. To such a pitch of excitement were the spectators roused by a regrettable and severe injury to Dean, the Mill outside right, that a free fight took place at one end of the ground. In a scuffle with Jarvis, the Mill left half, Dean was thrown heavily against the railings and he injured his side so badly it may be some time before he's able to play again. This would probably be on these advertising hoardings that the FA were talking about. This was not the only misfortune that befell Millwall. Shortly after the change of ends, Comrie was hurt, and like Dean, he had to be carried off the field, West Ham winning the game by 1-0. So it sounds all go there, free fight, fist fights in the crowd, players being thrown against the fence, against the advertising hoardings, which the FA have instructed must not have bare edges, bare metal edges. It sounds like a good old school Millwall versus West Ham game. The Western League still exists, actually. Interestingly, it's actually on the same level nowadays as the Isthmian League. It's a kind of a feeder to the Southern League. No, it's actually levels 9 and 10. Sorry, it's further down still than the Isthmian League. It feeds into the Southern League. Their champions are promoted to the Southern League Division 1 South. Nowadays, it's based almost exclusively with West Country, Cornish, Devonian, Dorset sides. But back in the day, it used to be treated as a second kind of competition inferior to the Southern League, but certainly just looking at the list of champions from the 1900s, I mean, you've got Pompey, Tottenham, Millwall won it twice in a row, 1908, 1909, West Ham had won it 1907, Bristol. I think there is a concern, I was reading in James Murray's Millwall Lions of the South book, that there was an actual concern on the workload being imposed on the players. It was pretty relentless stuff. Pitches were heavy. The North Greenwich pitch where Millwall had played at this time was known as a kind of a mud bank, largely speaking, because of the nature of the soil there. So the players were quite literally becoming exhausted by the relentless cup competitions, Southern League workload, and then throwing in the Western League. It was treated as a reserve competition. Often, certainly at Millwall, many of the first team players will be doubling up duties in the Western League as well. So we withdrew with the probably around about the time of the departure of Millwall from the Isle of Dogs to New Cross. I think that was the point at which the Western League was quietly shuffled off into the past. It would continue predominantly Western of England sides, Yeovil. I'm seeing won it in 1930s, Bristol Rovers. But then post-war, it becomes very much the likes of Weymouth, Barnstaple, Trowbridge, Salisbury, Saltash. Current champions, season curtailed in 2021 and 2020, but the current champions were a team called Willand Rovers from 2019, a Devon side. So there we are, that's the Western League. Two names mentioned in that little report. One was George Comrie, who was a Scot centre-half, played for Millwall from 1905 to 1909. He had previously played in Scotland for 3rd Lanark. He would play for 4 years. We don't actually have any stat details for George Comrie. He was seen very much as... reading the Lions of the South, he was seen very much as a kind of a reinforcement of the Mill defence in those early 1900s. He would leave us in 1909.
After his Mill career was over, George returned back to his native Scotland, to Dundee, where he's listed on Wikipedia as having made 73 appearances for Dundee, 1909 to 1912, scoring 5 goals in that period. Before returning to Huddersfield, 1912 to 13, and then Forfar Athletic back home again. During the First World War, George, which would affect all forms of, you know, aspects of life, but certainly football very, very deeply, listeners. George Comrie served as a sergeant in the Black Watch during the First World War. His son, Daniel Comrie, also served with the Scots Guards in the Second Conflict in 1939-45. George Comrie, dear listeners, 1885 to 1958. He died aged 73 in Falkirk in Scotland. The other name that caught my eye, which is quite a nice kind of cigarette card of him on Wikipedia. You can look this up. Alf Twigg, that's spelled T-W-I-G-G. He was an association footballer, as they put it. He played as a forward. Made 182 appearances for the Lions, or the Dockers, I should call them, 1905 to 1910. During the late years on the island, the Isle of Dogs, 182 appearances, as we said, and 88 goals. That's some scoring record by Alf Twigg. He came from Ashby de la Zouche in Leicestershire. He born in 1882, died 1957. He played as a forward, having been around some local clubs there, Burton Albion, Hinckley and Gainsborough Trinity. The bulk of his career was spent playing for the Dockers on the Isle of Dogs. One fascinating record that he holds here, though, which is relevant to this fixture, Twigg holds the record for the highest number of goals scored between London rivals Millwall and West Ham United. He scored 10 times against West Ham, his first goal being on April the 16th, 1906, and his last goal against the Hammers on the 26th of April, 1909. That is a fascinating and wonderful statistic. John Alfred Twigg, 1882 to 1957. R.I.P. Alf. But there we are, dear listeners. I hope you enjoyed that little section on a typically robust fixture played between
West Ham and Millwall, a 1-0 win on this occasion for the Hammers, but the usual standard FA inquiry to follow. Big thank you for listening, dear listeners. All the best.
Thank you for listening to Aston Millwall. If you enjoyed the show, please head over to Apple Podcasts and leave us a cheeky little review. Arrivederci, Millwall. Till next time.
Who do you want to watch?
Did you know that Xavi Hernandez used to scan over 8 times in the 10 seconds before receiving the ball? It's therefore not surprising that he rarely lost it. Scientific studies have shown just how important scanning is in soccer. Players who scan more, for example, make twice as many successful forward passes than those who scan less. But training this skill is difficult, and that's why thousands of players trust Be Your Best, the soccer training app in virtual reality, designed to improve players' game intelligence. To learn more, visit beyourbest.com and use code POD20 to get 20% off your first subscription.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey folks, it's Marc Maron from WTF. I've been talking to all kinds of famous people in my garage since 2009, including a sitting president.
You know, I don't imagine you were flying in here on the chopper thinking like, you know, I am nervous about Marc.
No, I wasn't.
Okay, well, that's good.
That would be a problem.
It would be a problem.
If the president was feeling stressed about
it. Coming to my garage.
Coming to your garage.
And now there's even more WTF when you subscribe to the full Marin to get weekly bonus content and all WTF episodes ad-free. Listen to WTF wherever you get podcasts and subscribe to the full Marin at go.acast.com/WTF.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.